everyone. Hope that you've had a great week. We are excited to bring you an episode today. Sebastian, how are you doing today?
Good. I'm good, Alex. How are you?
Very good. So instead of a banter question here, I just want to know, how excited are you on a scale of 1 to 10 for the semester to end?
Oh, I'm glad this is going to air after the semester ends. You know what? I'm really excited. Not because, you know, I don't like teaching or anything like that. It's just because it's been a rough semester for a variety of different reasons. And I think there's this psychological value of finishing up the semester that will give me a lot of relief on that end. And that's why I'm looking forward to it.
So rarely are we able to observe potential outcomes, but luckily today we can ask Patrick, whose semester has already ended. How excited are you now that the semester has ended?
And he's a good control for me, right?
Yeah. You guys, perfect match in the pre-period.
Yeah.
It's a staggered rollout of the semester ending. I feel great. You know, the leaves are turning here in Vancouver. It's starting to, the cherry blossoms are starting to pop. I think everybody is excited to spend a little more time outside and a little less time on Zoom. Mm.
That is good. Well, hopefully this is your last Zoom meeting standing in the way of being outside.
What about you, Alex?
Oh, I'm so excited. I forgot about me. I'm so excited. Chaos here. Well, our special guest today is Patrick Bayless. Patrick is an assistant professor and environmental economist at the Vancouver School of Economics at UBC, the University of British Columbia. He studies how people respond to environmental threats like climate change, air pollution, and wildfires. Patrick, thank you for being here. How are you doing today?
I'm great. And I just want to clarify that I'm very excited to be on this Zoom.
Thanks. We typically ask our guests to share a fun, but also shareable fact about themselves. So Patrick, what do you have for us?
So my fun fact is that I am a former professional athlete.
Oh,
but don't get too excited. I used to get paid $25 a game to play Ultimate Frisbee.
You get paid to play Ultimate Frisbee? Wow. Right. And how long does the game take usually?
Hour and a half, 2 hours.
That's a pretty good wage. That's a pretty good hourly wage.
That's a good way to think about it.
Yeah. So wait, tell us a little bit more. How did that started and how did it end it?
I've been playing Frisbee for a long, long time. And when I moved out to the Bay Area for grad school, I joined a couple teams out there, but one of the teams I joined was a professional team that just started. Like, there was a professional league that had just started. I think this was 2012. And so most of the time in grad school, I was actually playing for a professional team and then another club team as well. So It didn't fully pay my way through grad school, but they were like flying us to different locations to play up and down the West Coast and taking care of meals and stuff. So it felt kind of cool.
Wow. All right.
That is fantastic. But I have two follow-up questions. So are you a cutter or are you a handler? Which way do you go?
I'm a handler.
You're a handler? Okay. So then are you hammer, backhand, huck, forehand? I'm trying to think of them all.
I'm like a bread and butter guy. I'm just trying to move the disc from one side of the field to the other. So I'm like the, what's the good equivalent? Like less of a throwing quarterback and more of a distribution quarterback.
Interesting. Alex, how do you know so much about sports?
So I played unprofessionally in Tucson Ultimate Frisbee for a while, but I was very bad. I was reasonable at cutting and I could catch okay. But once it was like a black hole for the puck. I almost called it a puck, but whatever people call it, right? Like, this is betraying how bad I was at it.
So, that's so funny. Wait, I have a quick question about the economics. So like, the revenue you get is because people are paying to watch the games and then they split between teams. Is that right? Is that how the economics work? And that's the main revenue or ads, I guess?
Yeah, more or less. I mean, there's some sponsorship money. I don't think it was a money-making enterprise. I think there's a lot of people doing it for love. And hopefully hoping to eventually make some money, but there were crowds. I mean, it was neat. There was, you know, a few hundred people coming out to games. So
did you have fans? Did people like, hey, sign my shirt?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's fantastic.
That's so cool.
It was really neat. It was
a rookie card.
I imagine this, the following thing. Imagine you come back professionally, right? And then somebody comes to you to ask for an autograph. You're like, hey, can you sign me? It's like, oh, because I got that JPUB publication. No, because you're amazing. It's like
easily more people have seen me play Frisbee than have read my papers.
Well, speaking of papers, we would love to know about any type of work you're doing, anything you want to promote here.
I'm psyched to talk about a paper with Jed Boomhauer, who's a longtime co-author. And we've been doing work on wildfires for a little while. But we just started looking at some of the things that homeowners can do or municipalities can do to try to prevent homes from actually being destroyed in a wildfire. So we're looking specifically at how building codes have changed the probability of not only your own home burning, but your neighbor's home burning as a result of your home burning. And one of the things we see is that most building codes haven't had a material effect on the probability of like home destruction in a wildfire, except for this one that came out in California, in certain parts of California, a couple decades ago and led to a bunch of roof changes. And so these roof changes have actually had a really dramatic effect on the probability of home destruction and the probability of a spillover home destruction. We love any feedback that, you know, people have if they want to take a glance at any part of the paper.
And what's the result?
So the result is, so California implements this building codes change that affects only certain areas, certain like high fire hazard areas. And there's a complicated overlapping set of institutions determining what type of zone you're in and therefore what type of building code you have to adhere to. Anyway, it's nice for us because it creates a kind of natural experiment that lets us compare places that had this change versus places that didn't. And the places that had this change see like a pretty dramatic and rapid drop in. So in terms of like the vintage of your home, if you're built before or after the building code change, you see a pretty dramatic change in the probability of your home burning.
I have not read your paper, but I just downloaded it and I scrolled down and it's like pretty, like you just see figure three, which is like their regression discontinuity. You're like, oh yeah, huge probability decrease. It's like, it's pretty dramatic.
Yeah. Wow. What we're seeing is that, you know, we think they have a really material effect on, on this probability. And this is not the only reason why, you know, one might want to have building codes, but it certainly is a striking effect of that.
This is a great place to dive in into talking about a topic of the day. So let's give a little bit of a background. So Patrick, by the way, guys, has a blog, and again, we'll put it on the show notes. And he writes on a number of different topics. And one of those topics is about habits and productivity on kind of workflow or work habits that work for Patrick. So we'll talk a little bit about that and what he's learned in his journey of productivity throughout the profession. So maybe we can start about when did you start thinking about this? Was this during grad school? Was this when you started being a professor? Or when did this kind of like journey about caring about this stuff started?
I think this became kind of top of mind in grad school after the period of instruction kind of ended. And I don't know if you guys felt this way, but I hit my third year of grad school and just felt lost. You know, like nobody was asking me to turn in problem sets. And
right, what do I do?
suddenly it's like 3 to 4 years from now, generate a paper that gets you a great job. And that felt like a very overwhelming task for me. And I felt like I needed a way to organize myself and my day and what I was doing, you know, during the week to try to break that like big goal down into smaller and more achievable goals.
What did you start doing? Like, how did that plan came about? Did you start reading books or did you start going through, I'm going to try to plan my day or something like that?
I think, yeah, I picked up, I've been basically a frequent consumer of the quote productivity literature for a while. And I think it started then. I struggle a little bit to remember exactly what the first thing was. There's the David Allen Getting Things Done, like school of thought that kind of predates or like underpins a lot of this thinking. And that was initially kind of influential and, you know, helping me think about just like setting small goals and tasks to complete, trying to write and document what the plan is and then come back and figure out, okay, did I achieve the plan like on that day, on that week? And since then, over the years, like the degree of documentation sort of focus on task-oriented stuff, I found that to be not as useful as I initially thought it was. But that was kind of where I started, was just trying to like plan out my entire day and have a set of goals that I was trying to achieve.
And then you graduated, became a prof, and you've evolved your system. So maybe share with us a little bit of your kind of like day-to-day workflow, what it's like, you know. You wake up and how does your day go?
let me preface that first, this first by saying I don't consider myself to be exceptionally productive. I suspect that most people who are like extremely productive don't spend as much time as I do thinking about productivity. but I do feel like I get to like work with and observe a lot of people who just do a very impressive job of like continually churning out high quality work at a pretty rapid rate, while at the same time balancing a real life and balancing like, you know, activities that aren't work. And to me, that's an essential criteria for productivity. Is not, can you work 22 hours a day and generate a lot of stuff? It's like, can you work a reasonable number of hours a day and also get to enjoy your life as a human being?
That's great.
Can
you also preface or make a context about other personal constraints that you have, whether that's a family or not a family or anything like that? Because maybe that's important for the combo.
Yeah, I mean, I have a dog that I walk frequently. I don't have kids, so I think that makes, I don't have the same constraints as somebody who has a full family, and I think that definitely changes the calculation. So I'll let I guess Alex, I know you have kids. Sebastian, do you have kids?
I do not have kids. I just right now have a partner, and we also have a dog, but no kids yet. And so yeah, anyways, I like just to put that into context because people are like, how could you do this with this or that? And so anyways, I think also what's important.
I was going to pitch it to Alex because I would imagine like the constraints change a lot.
Basically, I like did all of my hard work, I think, before I had a kid. And then the past fair, year, right? I sort of sucked at being balancing and I'm trying to figure it out. So I don't feel totally comfortable like offering anybody advice on like how to balance work life with a family because like I got air quotes lucky that like COVID happened. So I have zero FOMO going on. No one's invited me to do anything. I just stay in my house every day. And then when the kid goes to bed, I do work. Right. So
but like, it's still a shock that you're adjusting to, right? So
that's true. I guess I'm just saying, I don't think I'm like particularly adept at I have multiple colleagues that have 5+ kids and they're also productive. And I'm like, I think there's actually 3 of the colleagues. they're like machines or something. I don't know.
Yeah, you need the Hermione like time control device.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's the tip of the day, right?
Or the Infinity Stones for those Marvel fans,
right?
Yeah, any of those.
All right, so let's go back to circle back into your day to day. Sorry about that diversion.
I did want to add a second disclaimer, maybe a third disclaimer. Now that we've established, and I face fewer constraints than a lot of people. And the second/third one is just that, like, what I'm about to describe is like the ideal day. And I fail to achieve that every single day.
You're amazing, by the way, for saying that. Cause like, I like you love this productivity stuff. I like read it for, I don't know, like to soothe anxiety or something, but like, I think most people just lie when they talk about this, like the 4 AM miracle. And I wake up and I do yoga for 3 hours. Then I like read New York Times and like, that can't be real.
I got my herbal tea going. Totally. I imagine that all of these authors are just out there. Like Cal Newport is out there, like having a bunch of beers and feeling terrible waking up Saturday mornings. And then he writes a blog post that is like only green leaf, leafy green plants. And I don't know.
I would love it if Cal Newport was like secretly like not at all productive. He's just like grinding it out.
Unfortunately, objectively, he's very productive.
That's true. Right. That is true.
Well, he has an Infinity Stone. So
that's there you go. There you go. Well, but I also, by the way, as you're telling us of your ideal day, you can also tell us of your actual day or an average day. So then we can both get us a feeling for both.
Okay. My ideal day, I wake up pretty early. I like waking up early. I like being up, you know, around the time the sun comes up, which varies quite a bit here in Vancouver. But getting up and like getting some time to myself before I introduce screens into my world. So this is a pretty common one in this literature on productivity, but you don't really want, if you can avoid it, to have like your phone as your alarm or like on your bedside, your computer on your bedside. Or I don't really want that because I find that one, it keeps me awake late at night, which makes my sleep less good. Two, it just like, it changes the nature of my whole day if the first thing I do is I flip open my phone and start reading it or seeing what's going on there. And I feel like I have a complicated relationship with my phone as is. I don't know. Again, I don't know how you guys feel about it, but I find that, you know, the more time I spend on that thing, the less happy I am and the less I feel like I'm accomplishing productive work. And it's an amazing tool, right? It helps us get where we want to go. It helps us stay in close contact with friends and family.
Right.
And I love it for that. And I love the technology of it. And then sort of it's magic. It's a magic tool. And at the same time, I think I'm a person with like pretty low active willpower to resist the allure of this magic.
Mm-hmm.
And so if I have like Twitter or Facebook or Instagram or any of these like, you know, infinitely refreshing objects.
Infinity pools.
The infinity pools. Exactly. Are you reading the Make Time book?
I'm reading it for the second time. Yeah.
So good.
Yeah.
If you have the infinity pools available to you, maybe we should explain what that concept is.
Please explain. This is on my list of things to read, but I have no idea what you're talking about. I thought it was like an infinity stone reference that I didn't understand.
So there's this book called Make Time by Jake Knapp and John Zaratsky. And they are former software engineers, software designers. And so they're some of the many people responsible for like building these apps that are insanely good at capturing your attention, because your attention is what is valuable to Facebook and to Instagram and to all these platforms and these applications. Anyway, so they make a number of points in this book about how to be more effective at doing what you want to do. But one of the things they talk about is how avoiding infinity pools is really helpful, and avoiding getting sucked into like the infinite scrolling of a Facebook or an Instagram or a Twitter. And I think it's real. I mean, for me, it's real that if I have access to those things, the minutes and the hours will just like melt away, and I won't have time for like the thinking that my brain, like the refreshing that my brain needs to do the work that we do.
Right. With exception of memes, because memes are important for my mental.
Super critical. I mean, the best thing to come out of the internet.
Yeah. So you wake up and you're trying not to be with screens for how long?
Probably half an hour or more, like making breakfast, getting going. Honestly, the more time I can avoid it, the better. At some point, I need to check in and make sure there's not some sort of fire burning with teaching or something like that. Like I need to check my email and see what's going on. But like this morning, I had a project that I wanted to plan. I'm talking with a co-author later this afternoon about this. And the project is really in its sort of initial stages, where we're designing, it's going to be experimental, and we're designing the experiment that we want to run. Mm-hmm. And the best thing for me with that kind of work is to have like an empty sheet of paper and a pen. If I have my computer open, it, and I know if I'm typing it up, it'll be saved for later. So that's a little bit easier. But I know if I have my computer open, I have access to the internet, and I have access to all these other distractions and the other things that are sitting on my desktop. So for me, if I can start the day with writing, whether that's like internet off, just typing or writing on a sheet of paper or something like that, those are my best days.
Mm.
And getting back to like the ideal versus actual, they're not most of my days. You know, most of my days, good day, I can like avoid the screens for half an hour while I'm getting ready to go. Sometimes I'll exercise in the morning, sometimes not. Often, you know, I have to like start teaching early or I have to catch up on some correspondence via email.
Mm-hmm. And related to that, when do you do email? Anytime, or do you block it off?
I'm trying to block it off more and more. So for me, my afternoons are the period of time when I'm least creative, most tired.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's when I try to do emails. I feel that my most creative times are in the morning, and my most productive in terms of writing times are in the morning. So if I can allocate like email time away from that.
Right.
And I think they talk about this in that book. They talk about how you're just more effective at getting through like a batch of emails than you are at dealing with them on a daily, like a minute by minute basis.
Yeah.
So I like this idea of like how you think about like the morning as like this protected time, and sort of the afternoon for like just like the stuff you got to do, but it maybe isn't as important to your end goals. Can you talk a little bit about these principles that you wrote up? It was really sort of clarifying these four principles you wrote up about just thinking about sort of how to deal with unstructured time as a researcher. Because I just kind of felt like holding these four principles in your head must help you figure out what you're going to do with that important time in the morning.
Absolutely. We should mention that I wrote up a blog post recently that's now up on the website. And this is where the principles are that we're talking about. So the first principle that I try to keep in mind is like, the goal is to get things done. And that sounds super obvious, right? But first of all, you need to define what your stuff is. So for us, our stuff is we need to write good research papers. And we need to teach well. And we also need to you know, perform our like service obligations. But identifying that these are the objectives laid out by the profession, and honestly, like these are the things I want to be good at, helps characterize like, is this activity contributing to that set of goals or is it detracting from that? For me, like obviously the infinity pools are not contributing to those goals, but also sometimes coding, I love recoding stuff. I love refactoring code. I love to take something problem. That like, runs in, you know, 20 minutes and get it to run in 18 minutes or 10 minutes or 5 minutes. Like, that's amazing.
Yeah. But if you're only going to have 2 days to do it, right? Like,
exactly. And if you're only going to run that code like five times, did you really save time?
Right.
So that's number one. The goal is to get stuff done.
And I think what I like about this too, is it like, once you know the stuff that you need to get done, it helps you plan. So I did this like faculty diversity thing we talk about sometimes on here. And I love this quote from there where Carrie Ann says, hope without a plan is just a wish. And I like think about that all the time. Cause like this, the goal of stuff you want to get done, it's like your hope, but like now you're like, well, now I need to figure out kind of like you said at the beginning, like how do I backwards induce how to get to that goal of that stuff? So
right on.
It can be really clarifying.
It makes me think of this is another thing that comes out of some portion of this literature, that your brain loves a good plan. And if you don't have a good plan, your brain isn't going to be motivated to be on your bad plan. So planning better is essential, just like being happier and more effective. Okay, the second kind of principle is that writing for me, and I think for many people, is thinking. Writing is not the act of taking thoughts.
I need to learn that.
And putting it, that's me too, right? It's not the act of taking thoughts that you already have and putting them onto paper or into your machine. It's a generative process. And you come up with new and better ideas as you're writing. Mm-hmm. If you don't write things down, you were going to lose them. Mm-hmm. So for me, if I'm just thinking about stuff, or I'm just, you know, if I'm not putting pen to paper in some form, usually it doesn't like materialize in better thoughts or better thinking.
Yeah. And what's nice about it is how, I guess like humbling is the right word it can be when you're like, oh, I had this really good idea. And maybe even like talked it over with a co-author on the phone or like, you know, before COVID, you were like having a beer or a coffee. And then when you go to write it up, you're like, oh, I think we're dumb. Like this is like obvious thing. Totally. Like, this is wrong.
I've had that experience so many times.
That's funny. I have a question about this because I feel like I've heard this before and I like it. And I, when I practice it the very few times, I'm like, yes, I want to do more of it. Like, do you guys have any tips on how to do more of it? And here's my two challenges. I love thinking, but sometimes I'm in the shower or sometimes I'm like walking the dock and it's hard to actually use my hands to type or anything. Or is there a way that you guys suggest to get more into this writing or to think?
I like writing cliffhanger abstracts. I'm still workshopping the right word for this, but this is like an abstract for a paper that you haven't written. So obviously you don't have results, but you're writing up the abstract of the paper that you would create. And so that is, it's a very manageable like length of text, right? An abstract is 150 words. And it's a thing that applies right into what we're trying to do. And so I try to think about taking a project and characterizing it as an abstract. Which kind of relates to what you're saying, but I don't know. I guess if it's in the shower, I don't know if you have like a readily available note-taking device in the shower, but voice memos are nice.
I use voice memos a lot because during non-COVID, I live like an hour and a half away from my work. So I like on my Apple Watch will like click this drafts thing and just like record myself talking. And then later when I go to read it and actually sit down, I'll realize a lot of the times like I wasn't actually, like that's not writing. That was just like recording my silly thought. But when I go to clean it up, I'll be like, oh, here's my like error in logic or something. Mm-hmm. But I guess like a really hard tip, and I think we maybe talked about this before with that writing smart notes book. I have started doing this when I do lit reviews for a paper, rather than copying and pasting like text from the paper where I'm like, okay, here's like their three or four main sentences that I want to do. I will try to write out how I want it to be in a future paper. Like I'll try to like write it in my own words, and I found pretty helpful for future me. Because even if it doesn't make it to my current lit review, it's like helping me think about how this fits into this context. Mm-hmm. And then it like sits in my brain like for a longer period of time.
I really like that. Where do you save?
Yeah, where I was about to ask that.
So I have a bunch of Markdown files and just a folder in iCloud called Markdown. And then like there's a couple subfolders like referee reports, comments on papers. And then I do like a daily and weekly journal. And honestly, like I want to be like you two, where you like you read and implement all of these different productivity techniques. But what I tend to do is I read them, consume them, switch my whole life over to them for like a week or two. And then like, okay, like the whole thing deteriorates really quickly. And this is the one sort of
regression
like,
to the mean.
Yeah, a mean of chaos. And this has been like the one system where like I actually continue to do this. I don't know why. Yeah, I'm like, cool. I do make these little notes. So,
I mean, the best tool is the one you're actually going to use, right?
Fair.
Yeah.
Yeah, what's that like? The best camera is the one you have in your pocket.
I love that. That made me. That saved me money from buying a new DSLR.
Right. The best country is the one you're in. That's not true.
unless you're in Canada.
What about you? What's the tool that you use for this writing? It's just like you save it in Word or something like that, or something.
So I'm a lot like Alex in that I switch tools frequently, and I'm like resistant to recommending any one thing, because 6 months from now I'll be like, I can't believe I recommended that.
Yeah.
Right now I'm using Rome Research, which is like it's a cult like tool.
I was gonna say, the cult following. Of
Rome. literally they call themselves a cult.
Yeah.
For me, it's like the lowest barrier to entry between what I'm thinking about, like getting what I'm thinking about down in a way that I can find it later. Mm-hmm. But I've tried, I don't know, you name it, I've probably tried it. I really like Markdown because it feels more future-proofed than a lot of things. Like I write most of my slides, I write, you know, pretty much everything I can in Markdown at this point, because the less time you spend writing notation and not just notation, but like if you write in LaTeX a lot, like begin, itemize, end, itemize, all this stuff, the less time you can spend doing that, the more time you can spend getting like the things in your head onto the medium that you're working in, the better. And I find that Markdown and Rome Research are good for that. Complete on the principles, which we kind of covered already, but three is don't use your brain as a hard drive. Your brain sucks at storing information. And the more information you try to keep in like your active short-term memory, the less of your brain, I am obviously not a neuroscientist, but the less of your brain you're gonna actually be able to use to like generate new ideas. Mm-hmm. So I have a bad enough memory as it is, and it's very taxing to try to remember how I coded something last time, or my schedule for the day, or like what my big goals are. So one of the reasons why I like writing these blog posts is I actually have no idea. I think I am probably the number one consumer of my own
That's
material
cool.
in the sense that I go back to this stuff all the time and I find it really useful.
Yeah.
But it's very important for me to know that other people might also read it to make sure that like, I have the right incentive to make it readable. But ultimately, I refer to this stuff all the time because it's not in my memory anymore and I can just go back and pick it up here. And so that way I can try to use more of thinking cycles, again, not a neuroscientist, to actually come up with new ideas and to think about how I want to do these things better.
That makes sense.
And then the last principle we've also kind of talked about already, but that I want to do things in a way that's pretty future-proof. And I'm realizing like how quickly I switch from tool to tool, because I think, you know, part of me just loves learning a new tool and learning a new system. But, you know, inevitably that means that 6 months ago I was using something entirely different. And if there's no way to go back to that and reference that material, then I sort of just wasted that time. Mm-hmm. Now I have to relearn it. So I think having Markdown is great, stuff that backs up really easily and stuff that is searchable, like easily findable.
Yeah.
Super important. I don't know. Do you guys use if you have Mac, if you have OS X, Alfred is the best. So rather than trying to like, this is sort of don't use your brain as a hard drive too, but rather than like trying to navigate a really complicated document structure, or I don't know, there's all these different like ways of organizing your files that you'll find on the internet. Mm-hmm. And they're fine. I mean, I think I use one of them, but I found it much easier just to type the name of the thing I'm looking for and go there.
I use Alfred and I've used it for years and I love it. And then I have a Mac too. And I love using MD find in terminal when I'll be like, I know I use that word or something in this line of code or like in one of my like markdown files. And since it's all on my Mac and it's searchable by the text within there, you could either do this in Alfred, you could search within, or you can use MD find if you don't have Alfred. And like, it just searches all the files on your computer and it's fast to find
So that's brilliant. It's really fast too, huh?
It's super fast. So on Macs, I might get stuff slightly wrong, but I'm pretty sure Mac indexes all of your files and creates, it's easy to search. It's like got some like, I don't know, like SQL database going on behind the scenes, which is like probably bad for security, but like it's good if you're trying to search things really quickly. Mm-hmm. So you can use, you just open up terminal, type an MD find, and then like some word. And I use this, I'm pretty like anal about code now and like knowing how figures and stuff are made, but I was not always this way. And so sometimes I'll be like trying to find the code that made a figure. I know it's on my computer. So I'll find the phrase that was used like in the figure. So I know it's in the code. And then I'll like MD find that. And I'm like, okay, it's this R file. Then it's like my stupid downloads folder or something.
Cool. I've never used MD find.
I'm not a Mac user. I'm in a Windows user. And there's a couple things that, well, one is if you're interested more in don't using your brain as a hard drive, there's a whole deep dark hole called building your second brain. And I think Tiago Forte is like really big on this thing. So that's a rabbit hole that if you're interested in that, you can go. But so it's interesting. I have like a Dropbox folder called General Code, where it's like anytime I see like a figure in a different paper in a presentation or something like that, that I like, I'm like, oh, that's really cool, or something on Twitter, I usually either ask, or if it's publicly available, I, you know, copy and paste it. And then I, you know, name it on a whatever do file or a script and just put it in this thing called General Code. That has been like super useful. It's very disorganized, right? It's just a bunch of do files. But I immediately like, oh my gosh, I wanted to make this figure for this paper. Okay, I go to this thing called General Code. Or if I wrote a code that I think it's very general and I know I'm going to use it a lot, like event study kind of code, then I create a little bit of a general version and put it under General Code. And so I've been referring to that a lot more than I thought before. Because before I was like, okay, at some point I did something really cool in one of these like rivers of analysis. And then I was like trying to find it and couldn't. But that's another way of organizing, you know, that kind of setup.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, I think of Alex, you have that event study code, this data event study code that you made public. And I've sent lots of collaborators and students to that because it's super helpful, not just for you, I'm sure, but for like anybody who's trying to learn how to run these things.
Before I posted stuff like that online, I was worried that I would be embarrassed for like posting crappy code on the internet. Cause like inarguably that is crappy code, right? It's like not super well commented. It's kind of confusing. It has needless redundancies. But just like Sebastian was talking about, I was like, man, I've gone to the same thing over and over again. I'm just trying to make it a function. And then every time I use it and a bug happens or somebody else uses it and a bug happens, I'll try to fix it. And I don't know, it's kind of functional.
Have this also habits that you have maybe on mornings and writing and planning. You want to give us some highlights on those habits?
The other piece of writing is thinking for me is that, and this is related to, you know, publishing blog posts and writing for an audience. Writing for an audience is super helpful for ensuring that you are forced to write clearly. And writing for an audience that you know might edit your work is even more helpful.
Oh gosh.
Yeah. So if you're writing something, you know, to a collaborator or a co-author and you're saying, okay, this is a section of the paper, you know, that we're thinking about writing, it's just a very good way to keep yourself super honest about what you're putting together. Because if you're just writing for yourself, I mean, that's good. It's good to write stuff for yourself, I've found, but there's always the temptation to kind of take shortcuts because you say, well, I'll remember that later. I'll go find that citation later. So I like thinking about that as I'm doing writing tasks. And that's, I think, one of the reasons why I like making things public is because it adds that layer of accountability.
It's kind of like going to the gym with a workout buddy and like let that person down. It's like, yes, I'll go, but I would have slept in today.
One of the things I'm stealing from Make Time that I like, and I'm trying to implement myself, is to pick a highlight for your day.
I love
that. You love that?
Yeah.
It's so good.
Let me tell you a little bit of an anecdote there. So, it's a good connection between the two things we're talking
about.
You
should see how excited these guys are right now. They're both grinning from ear to ear.
I've adopted a number of mentees throughout the years, and I started that noticing, you know, I talk to them every month or so, something like that, and with some of them less so. And I really wanted to provide quote unquote value out of our relationship. And I started doing a newsletter that is only for my mentees. And so I feel pretty comfortable sharing some of those thoughts that I wouldn't be sharing with the rest of the audience. But anyways, that forced me to write and to write for an audience, right? Which is exactly a lot of those things that you guys are saying. It's highlighted there. So it's a little bit of a private blog. And then the one that I just talked about is this one, which is the highlight. And I'll let Patrick talk about what it is, but I've been trying to also implement it as well. And, you know, I don't do it every day, but I feel like the days that I do it, I am much more excited about those days, at least that I think about.
I totally agree. And I think the payoff of the highlight is that it makes your days feel like they have a bit more of a focus. I think I referenced earlier, like getting a little burnt out on having a million tasks that you're just trying to check off the list, which is kind of where you end up with a lot of this productivity stuff. You end up with, okay, you know, here's all my goals. Here's my sub goals. Here's my sub goals. I'm going to check these things off. And like every day, when I've checked off all my tasks, I'll move on to the next ones. And it just gets to feel like kind of a grind. Mm-hmm. And then you look, I would look back in my week and I would just feel like, you know, I had gone to work and I was grinding the whole time. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's good because you are getting stuff done, but I also find it's just like a bit mentally draining. Mm-hmm. So what I like about the highlight, which I guess I should say what the highlight is.
Yeah, I need to know. What is the secret that's going to change my life?
And that's all we have for today's podcast. Thank you. No one will know.
So their idea, this is again from the Make Time book. Their idea of a highlight is that you have like one, let's say 60 to 90 minute thing. Could be a task, could be like hanging out with your kids, could be like making a project on in your backyard or something like that. It doesn't have to be work-related. But you pick a highlight that at the end of the day, if you were talking to your spouse or you're talking to, you know, your mom or dad, you would say, oh, like my highlight today was I did this. And so my highlight today, talking to you guys.
Yeah.
You know, and so when I talk to my mom on the phone, I'd be like, I talked to Alex and Sebastian. It was great. And so each day has like a different focus. And so you're doing other things besides the highlight. Obviously, like that 60 to 90 minute task is not the only thing you do in your day, but that's the one that's kind of the focal point that you're really, you know, ensuring that you do your best to get done.
So I like that quite a bit. And that's like a cooler, happier person version of this like Brian Tracy thing, like eat the frog or like most important task. Mm. So like, I always try to like, which I've embraced that where I'm like, okay, what's like the thing I got to focus on tomorrow? But often it's like, do this referee report or whatever. I like highlight because it could be a fun thing too.
Totally.
It could encompass that MIT.
So, and there's a couple of things that I want to add to that. So one is, you know, it's nice when you decide to highlight before your day starts or the night before or something like that, which is great. But you could also change it within the day if you need to. And I like thinking about I'm deciding what is the thing I'm really going to savor and enjoy. And so sometimes like, you know, today I can say like, okay, I'm really going to savor the podcast today. And really I force myself to like fully pay attention. Not that I'm trying to get other stuff done while this is happening, but I really savor it and pay attention. Sometimes, for example, I really enjoy cooking and I'm like, my highlight is going to be that I'm going to cook this meal today. And just the fact that I'm mindful about that, it makes it savor a lot more. I think it's really helpful. One thing that has helped me on this is I had a friend doing this thing called 1 second a day, which is an app that you record a second and each day. And then you have a 365 second video. And I've correlated those things. So like I choose the highlight and I'm like, okay, I'm going to make a video, a 1 second video of that. And so then it reinforces this idea of like, I'm going to savor this moment.
It'd be sad if those are 365 referee reports.
Yeah. I put as a highlight before like catching over email. So Friday afternoon, I was like, I'm going to catch over
inbox zero.
Archive your last message. That's the second for that day.
Yeah.
That's pretty good. I would do that on habits. I think a lot about effort management in that it's easy to convince yourself that working an extra hour or two into the night is the right thing for getting this last piece of a project done or this last thing out. But for me, I always find that that leaves me drained for the next day or even the next couple of days. So I'm trying to do more like managing a constant stream of work and then making sure that I actually get some leisure time to recharge. And for me, a lot of time, that leisure time looks at least partly like doing some exercise. So I think this is different for everybody, but I've come to find that I have like lulls in my day, like often in the afternoon or just before lunch, And if I can squeeze a run in or just getting outside and going for a walk, that's super helpful for my happiness and for my energy levels for the rest of the day.
Used to work out a lot, but since teaching started, I feel like I just haven't given myself time, and that kind of sucks. Obviously the weather was also crappy, but I feel like I need to get back to that because I do feel like I was enjoying myself more when I was doing a lot more activity and exercise.
For me, that's been a really nice thing about COVID is like more control over my daily schedule. And like, I am like you, where I work best in the morning. And then I found I've started working out in like the early afternoon. And then I do all the nonsense that I like kind of don't like doing, like answering emails and stuff after that. And it's like this nice kind of like mental switch where I'm like, all right, the hard part of my day is done. Now I just have to do the like taskmaster stuff.
Maybe we can talk about a couple more our profession specific thoughts, since I think that's probably most of the audience. One that I've found really valuable is getting to a minimum viable research product for a project is super important. Like if you, again, Silicon Valley has this saying, fail fast. So if you know, if you can figure out for a potential project what the absolute points of failure are, not like a place where you would need to pivot the idea, but where, you know, if we can't get the data for this piece of it, we cannot write this paper. The first thing you got to do is find out if you can get those data. But just figuring out what the points of failure for the project are likely to be and targeting those points in terms of pushing the project forward along that dimension.
Right.
Seems like a really, I think, helpful way to design research. That being said, I guess the caveat to this is you don't want to kill projects too fast because every single project, as I've conceived of it, has looked very different from the final product. Mm-hmm. So you have to balance that with allowing yourself to like move to different ideas. But I guess the takeaway is don't get your data 80% clean in 5 hours and then spend like 5 weeks cleaning the last 20% if you don't think that's going to make a material difference in whether the project works or not. Like save that final cleaning for later.
I don't think I ever heard of this. This is really interesting. I think I apply that in my romantic relationships. I'm going to fail fast. No, I'm just kidding. I'm going to find the thing that is wrong with this person immediately. And that's why I've been so successful. But that's interesting. And I think... I also acknowledge that there is like not a caveat, but I wonder if your relationship to the concept of failing fast changes over time, because I think as you become a more seasoned researcher, you're allowed to see how different projects can evolve and into other things. Whereas I think maybe when you're a younger researcher, that's a lot harder to see. So I wonder if there's like that a scale of transforming a project into something else that is also really viable, but maybe not really the original thing. Because I found that, I would say that when I was a younger researcher, I'm like, okay, this doesn't work. The project is dead, done. And now I'm like, oh no, I could have just done this other angle and it still is a viable project.
I think that's a really good point. And I think that links to something important for me, which has always been getting feedback from other people. That was really important as a grad student. I still think it's really important. Like other people can see your project for what it is much better than you can. And so putting something together to put in front of somebody else and to say, this is where I'm at. What do you think? Whether that's a peer or an advisor or a mentor can provide some really valuable feedback. And then doing that in the context of thinking about like, okay, what are the failure points in this project? What should I aim for? Do you think, or like, how should I try to transition it? I think really links to what you're saying and is maybe better than just being like, fail it as fast as possible.
Right. Like relationships, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Thank you so much for having this conversation with us today. We sometimes try to do a summary, so obviously I won't be able to cover everything, but there was a lot of good stuff in here. And I just kind of want to rewind to the beginning because that's where I think many of our listeners might be. That a lot of these tools, if you're like in the class mode of grad school, a lot of these ways of thinking may not be immediately clear because you're getting assignments assigned to you, you're getting prelims, you're having your tasks given to you. But once your sort of period of unstructured time begins, whether that's your second or third year or fourth year, it can seem kind of overwhelming to get a job. And then again, once you become an assistant professor, if you end up going that route, if you're just like get tenure in X years, right? That's a really tough sort of unstructured goal. So what Patrick's done here is sort of outlined the way he thought about this and the way his thoughts have changed across time, moving towards this bigger goal, breaking it down into smaller, more achievable goals. So building off of thoughts of people like David Allen and all sorts of like productivity nerds that all three of us seem to love, documenting and planning things seems to be really important. and just try to get an idea. This was his sort of a productivity tip number one of like, what's the stuff you actually need to do to get done with that? Mm-hmm. Number two, don't be afraid of biting the bullet and actually trying to write instead of just thinking things out loud, right? That's not enough, right? You need to put pen to paper because at the end of the day, a journal submission is potentially the goal. Three, along with that, you can't remember everything, right? So David Allen has this quote, you want to mind like water. If you're trying to store everything in your brain all the time, you're not going to be able to have that state. I can't have that state anyways, but I definitely would be able to if everything was in there. And then four, try to future-proof everything as much as possible. That way you don't have to worry about changing platforms or other things and just try to make it as flexible, but it be realistic with the tool set that you're using. Actually, just a little tidbit that I took away here is changing your focus for each day to have one of these highlights. I love that. Like I'm going to try that tomorrow because I do what's my most important task.
Right.
But it's always the most like boring thing. Like I don't know. Sometimes it might need to be the highlight.
You could use spend time with Ava, right? That's your highlight of the day.
Yeah, it could be. I can't do that every day or I would never do work because that's way more fun. It turns out playing with like kids' toys is way more fun than econ research.
Every week, we like to ask our guests for a recommendation of the week. This can be anything, a podcast, a command, an app, a song, a quote, a book, kitchen recipe, anything that improves your life in a small way. Patrick, what is your recommendation for the week?
I deleted my mail apps off of my phone. Another product of the book that we've been talking about. And I love it. I love not having that access to distraction that kind of, not just you, that I might flip it out when I'm talking to people or when I'm hanging out with somebody. It's that if I'm walking from place A to place B and I flip out my phone and I check my email. Once I'm at place B and I'm, let's say, hanging out with friends, whatever I saw in my email is now churning in the back of my brain. So if you have phone addiction problems like I do, try deleting those apps and see if you have sort of more clear headspace when you're actually.
Did you miss an important opportunity? Maybe you got invited to something and you didn't. I'm just kidding.
It has yet to be a problem.
Yeah, there you go.
I don't get that many important opportunities.
If you're not willing to go that far, I distinctly remember this as like a turning point in my anxiety with my phone life, where I was with one of my friends hanging out, and I my phone kept dinging with email things, and he was like, "Dude, why do you have that thing on notification? Turn off the notifications."
Yeah,
and I did, and it was like immediately freeing.
Yes.
I've not regretted it at all.
Right.
Kill the little red dot. Yeah.
Yeah. They're gone.
The Nobel Prize sent me an email saying that if I respond to the email in 30 seconds, I would get a Nobel, but I missed it too. So, Alex, what is your recommendation of the week?
All right. Mine is simple, but like a big deal for me personally. Like Patrick was describing with impulse control, I have that for like all things in my life, right? Like if the TV's on already, I'll just like sit down and watch it or whatever. Same thing with like food. If I'm like, I have food, I'll just go eat it. So I recommend buying a kitchen scale if you are like this at all. And it makes like if you want to cook anything or bake, first of all, it's very useful for that to like actually get the right amounts and be precise. But also like, if I'm like, what is actually a serving of peanut butter or a serving of Cheez-Its or something, right?
Right. 8 ounces.
It's very humbling to realize, you know, like exactly how small this is. And it's an important part of my losing of the COVID-19.
Yeah. Actually, average serving sizes are a lot smaller than I thought they were once I started measuring them. I'm like, this is not a serving size. This is an appetizer. You know?
Yeah.
Try that tonight.
It's rough. Like you are running around doing ultimate frisbee and things, so you're fine, right? But like if like you're trying to limit calories at all and you're like, oh, I just had like a few Cheez-Its, like, oh, I actually had 4.5 servings of those. I
didn't realize this. It's impossible to have just a few Cheez-Its.
Yeah, that's right. This is you know, goes very in theme with your recommendation of a meat thermometer. Just more precise cook.
You know. To be honest, like I don't have any cooking skills, but I'm very good at reading and following directions. That's why I like coding. At least when it comes to coding and cooking and like having a meat thermometer, like just get this thing to like 124 degrees.
Right.
It's so much more doable than like, right. Like sear it till it's medium rare or something. I don't know.
That's funny.
Yeah. What about you, Sebastian?
My recommendation of the week is going to be a web tool called Wakelet. So that is Wakelet. And the only thing this service does is actually really simple. It's you put up, let's say, a bunch of links and then it creates a link based on that. But it's like visually appealing, very simple. So for example, I used it a lot in, let's say somebody on Twitter says like, oh, does anybody know any set of papers? So instead of like copy and pasting each link for each paper, I just say like, oh, here's a link. And then it puts all the 5 papers there, for example. So very, very easy to use. For example, I also have a Wakelet on or a link that goes to any kind of a background noise playlist, whether that's in Spotify or any other kind of service. So I just, every time I find one, I just drop it there. And
wait, so is it like a Google Doc type thing, but for like links, or like what does it do for you beyond like a notes app?
It essentially creates a link. It creates a web link that I can share easily with anyone.
Oh, to that list of links.
That list. Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. That's exactly Wakelet. Right. So cool. Yeah, and I'll put you guys in the chat, but I'll put it in the show notes too. I created a number, like for example, that's the way I save literature on like Medicaid or something else. I just like, every time I find a paper, I put it in my link of Medicaid papers. And so then it's all stored there for forever, I guess.
It must be a very long list.
Yeah, I mean,
there's a lot of Medicaid papers.
There are Medicaid papers on a particular topic, but that's
yeah.
Well, thank you so much for being here with us today. If people want to find more about you and your work, where should they go?
Thanks so much for having me. This has been a lot of fun. They can just go to my website. It's patrickbaylis.com. So Patrick, P-A-T-R-I-C-K, Baylis, B-A-Y-L-I-S.com. And yeah, shoot me a note if anything comes to mind on the blog or on the research. I'd love to chat.
Awesome.
Thank you so much for joining us. This is great.
Yeah, that's all that we have for you folks today. Make sure you subscribe and leave us a review. Thank you for tuning in. Bye.
See ya.
Take care.